Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 18th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, a lot of housekeeping and internal stuff to kick off this week's show with. The first thing I want to tell you guys is that I'm making this recording on Monday the 15th of June, and that yesterday we had a really great get-together here in the Pugetopolis, wherein we welcomed home not one, not two, but three, count them, three new white families of Northwest migrants. I say again, families, not retirees, not t-shirt youth, not the usual embittered single and divorced men who are so often associated with white nationalism, understandably so, due to the fact that they have been so personally abused by America. These are for real families with young children who will be making their homes and lives and raising those children here in the homeland, where they're supposed to be. Yes, guys, it's starting to happen. Slowly, 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 but happening nonetheless. With glacial slowness, the word is finally percolating out there in the cyber wilderness through the skulls full of mush that there is a place where you can meet and speak with real white people. Not an email address or a chat room handle where you can't see or know who it is you're really talking to. Slow, slow, slow as molasses in wintertime. Our people around the continent are finally starting to get it and to wrap their minds around that first step of physically coming here, that initial step that has to take place before anything else can happen. Now, since I've been shouting and screaming about this since 2008, it's pretty obvious that somehow we have to speed this process up. But I think that may be about to happen because this is kind of like an avalanche, which has begun at first by one small snowball slowly rolling downhill, and then it picks up speed and mass, and all of a sudden the whole mountain is moving. Right. Moving right along here. The call-in show is, at this point, scheduled for Thursday night, June the 18th, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific time, which would be 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. The Skype number will be sent out to members of the Northwest Revolution email list either tonight or tomorrow. Now, after some consideration, I've decided not to announce the number itself in public at this time, because this is the first time we're trying to do this, and although it looks like we've developed a system and a workaround for some glitches, and we will in fact be able to record a program, there's still a lot of bugs fluttering around through the air with this thing, and I don't want to have idiots calling up and wasting our time with stuff that I'm just going to edit out. Goat dancers and other fools are banned from this show, but we will be running on a time limit, and I don't want any of them calling up and expending valuable airtime and making me edit them out when that airtime could be taken up with legitimate callers. A few preliminary remarks here. Numero uno, this is not a live talk show like Rush Limbaugh or whatever. You will not be able to listen to it like a proper radio show. This is you calling me at a set time and our co-host Don, and rapping with us about whatever is on your mind, with us recording the conversation, and then later on, me or someone else will edit the file and get rid of all the stutters and the uhs and the ahs and the you knows and the lip smackings and the burps and the dead air and whatnot. And then once the MP3 file is cleaned up, we'll upload it to the northwestfront.org website just like a regular RFN. When we get a little more comfortable with the technique, and when I can reasonably promise a regular allocation of time at least every couple of weeks, we may or may not switch to Blog Talk Radio or some other similar paid service and attempt to run a live call-in show in the true Rush Limbaugh style. I can't say for sure on that. Okay, now, a couple of common questions that arise fairly often regarding the Northwest novels. This is from Jason in Milwaukee. Dear HAC, since you just sent this out, I have a couple of quick questions I hope you have time to answer. I'm working through the backlog of podcasts, and I have been for a couple of months straight. Just as an aside, I am always amazed that anyone would actually download and listen to over 5 years worth of this show, but apparently some of you do. I'm about in October of 2012, and a few podcasts ago you mentioned that you had signed novels. I'm by no means any kind of collector or anything, because for one I hate clutter and being around senseless junk. However, if I was to be, having one of the books is not necessarily a bad thing. My reason for asking if you have books for sale is because I would rather send you my money and not Amazon. Secondly, is it possible to purchase the Northwest novels at a wholesale price from somebody? Okay, Jason, answering your second question first, define wholesale. Yeah, if someone genuinely wants a big consignment of a particular Northwest novel, they can basically send me the money and I can order direct from the publisher using my author's discount. Plus, there are occasional sales and discount coupons and whatnot issued by these print-per-order publishers. Plus, most of them, there is a per-copy discount. I believe with most, it generally starts around either 15 or maybe 25 copies. If you order up to 25, it's X number of dollars. And if you order more than 25, the per copy price starts to drop. And if you order more than 50, you get a lower price, so forth. So you get the idea. If you want a serious bulk order, contact me and we'll get it sorted out and have the books shipped directly to you. One good thing also about these big orders is you can usually get free shipping out of these people. Secondly, yes, I will always be glad to send someone a signed copy, but given my constant distraction, if you send me the money and I promise you a signed copy, you need to ride the hell out of me by email, because the combination of constant interruption and encroaching senility and short-term memory loss is not a good one. And lacking a personal assistant or staff of any kind with the best will in the world, I will simply forget or lose track. You guys, anytime I tell you that I'm going to do something, you harass the hell out of me until I get it done, or else I won't do it. I will simply forget or lose track or get distracted by something else. I know that's very inefficient of me, but what can I tell you? No offense will be taken, believe me, if you keep on harassing me by email or by phone saying, "Harold, Harold, when are you going to do that thing you said you were going to do?" Okay, this is from Richard in Idaho. Hi, Harold. I read the Northwest novels in the following order, and it worked out pretty well for me in terms of understanding things. The Brigade, Hill of the Ravens, A Mighty Fortress, A Distant Thunder, and am now reading Freedom's Sons. Rich, that actually is not a bad order to read them in. The order in which they were written is Hill of the Ravens, A Distant Thunder, A Mighty Fortress, The Brigade, and Freedom's Sons. Right now, I would say that whatever order you read the first four in, Freedom's Sons should be the last because it deals with the future and the first 50 years of the Northwest American Republic existence. Now back to Rich's email. The audio format of the prologue to Freedom's Sons made it easier for me to accommodate into my schedule. Now, I assume he's referring to the reading I did of the prologue with all the neat sound effects later added in by that one comrade whose name I'm sorry to say now escapes me. You know, the one with all the artillery fire and the machine guns and the weird electronic noises and sound effects, that sort of stuff. All right, now back to Rich. Do you have plans for the reading of the rest of Freedom's Sons? I've narrated theater before and would be willing to provide an excerpt for you if having it narrated would be helpful for you. No charge. However, given my schedule, I cannot provide firm guarantees on turnaround times for each chapter. But once I commit, it will happen, Lord willing, and if the river don't rise. Okay, that's kind of the situation I'm in right now, Rich. As those of you who receive the organizational letter will know, my time has reached such a premium that I'm going to have to become downright brutal in allocating that time, in creating a schedule and sticking to it, and in ruthlessly battling against interruption or the insertion of endless long-term projects that will consume my time with no immediate upside. I have had people after me for a long time begging me to read the Northwest novels onto CD or some other audio format. I frankly doubt I'm going to get to it anytime soon. Now, the problem is not just time for me to do so, it's that these novels are so long that even one of the first three, the short ones, would probably be a collection of at least 24 CDs. It would have to go on a thumb drive, and I don't know if many cars now have thumb drive players, which seems to mostly be why people want it on CD, so they can hear a Northwest novel being read to them while they're stuck in traffic or commuting down some freeway. A suggestion has been made that I pick one of the shorter novels and serialize it on Radio Free Northwest, but that would take up an immense amount of time on the show here and also lead to more charges that I'm basically just phoning it in. Now, Rich, if you want to do some samples for me of your reading style on these books and send them to me in MP3 file form, not only will I be glad to listen to them, but if they're any good, I may play them on Radio Free Northwest. But bear in mind that we now have a much tighter time limit, and so your excerpts would have to be, less than 15 minutes. I'm not quite sure you could get a whole chapter in there in 15 minutes, certainly not one of the longer and more detailed ones, but look, give it a shot. Show me what you can do. I'm always willing to take a look at what you guys want to do or can do or are willing to do for the cause. So yeah, Rich, send me some of those files and we'll diddle around with them and see what we can do with them. I may end up asking you to read one of the shorter books. We'll just have to see how that plays out. Now we're going to hear from Comrade Adam again. After my comments to Brian last week, I hate to sound like I'm making a practice of berating our own people, and I'm not, but something he says here caught my attention. See if you can figure out what it is.
Greetings, comrades. This is Comrade Adam from Milwaukee, Oregon. So today I thought I'd just rant and rave on some random things and whatever comes to my head. So about the western border of the Republic for when the time comes, if we were to extend it westward to about halfway through North America, it would probably end somewhere either in Michigan or Minnesota due to all the states back east and liberal sand being all real tiny, like the border of Vermont and Canada. So after that, it would basically be climate and demographics for extending how far we go south, which would maybe down to northern Utah, maybe. And then we could probably, assuming we had military superiority, go all the way up to the Arctic Ocean and take over everything to the Pacific Ocean. And that would give us a nice big chunk of North America. And I know what Covington says in the novels for Operation Strikeout and Freedom Sons and whatnot, but we're white men and we should be able to take more back. However, we are going to have to get the core homeland of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and the western third of Montana to do any of that. Short-stopping in North Dakota or Wyoming or Colorado or someplace that's nice and white does not count. You have to come to the Northwest to help us build the party to create the revolution so we can get the facilities in Seattle with Boeing, what's left up there anyway, or from Silicon Forest down here by Portland and out in the Willamette Valley. And whatever industry that's still around the Northwest, which is a lot more than you would think, and probably a lot more than out in the Rust Belt, where everything's just rusting away. So, yeah, we can do more. Then we can have a eugenics campaign in liberal sand to basically protect white people, whether they like it or not. And although they will outward despise us for it, we will be doing them a favor, and deep down inside, they'll know it. So, that's basically planned for the future, as far as North America goes, if we can actually win. But that's all dependent on you coming to the core area of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and the western third of Montana to get this show on the road. Believe me, guys, I've seen it in my mind's eye, and it's definitely worth having. I don't know why it's not worth having in your mind's eye. Come on, guys, let's go.
Okay, now, did you catch Adam's reference to the quote-unquote western border of the Northwest Republic? Now, actually, from our point of view, it would be the eastern border, but like pretty much all Americans, Adam still has the old habit of thinking of this as one country, which is sort of spread like butter on bread from east to west, with the center of it all being on the East Coast in Washington, D.C. and New York and maybe Boston, where all those damn Yankee abolitionists came from back in the day. I suppose that harkens back to the old days of manifest destiny, when it was believed to be God's will that the Anglo-Saxon race, their words at the time, would sweep from the Atlantic to the Pacific in one mighty wave, which I admit is kind of how it happened in the 19th century, and somehow swallow up Canada, which is what the War of 1812 was really about, except we got our asses kicked, and create this great republic of educated businessmen and Harvard graduates and hairy-legged Yankee women telling everybody else how to live, ruled from Washington, D.C. Now, that was Lincoln's view of it. That was why he fought the Civil War. Actually, he didn't like niggers any more than anybody else did at the time, and he wanted to repatriate them all back to Africa after the war, which was what got him assassinated by Charles Sumner and Edwin Stanton. Most Americans to this day have a hard time envisioning more than one country existing in the lower 48 states, because we have grown up with all this one nation indivisible crap. Old habits and old thought patterns die hard. This is Doc Watson.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been riding on the Tennessee stud. I had some trouble with my sweetheart's paw, and one of her brothers was about outlaw. I sent her a letter by my Uncle Fudd, and I rode away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. We drifted on down into no man's land. We crossed that river called the Rio Grande. I raced my horse with the Spaniard's foal till I got me a skin full of silver and gold. Me and a gambler, we couldn't agree. We got in a fight over Tennessee. We jerked our gun, then he fell with a thud, and I got away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. I got just as lonesome as a man can be, dreaming of my girl in Tennessee. The Tennessee stud's green eyes turned blue, cause he was a-dreaming of a sweetheart too. We loped right back across Arkansas. I whooped her brother and I whooped her paw. I found that girl with the golden hair, and she was a-riding on the Tennessee mare. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. Stirrup to stirrup and side by side, we crossed the mountains and the valleys wide. We came to Big Muddy, then we forded the flood on the Tennessee mare and the Tennessee stud. I put a little baby on the cabin floor, a little horse coat playing around the door. I love that girl with the golden hair, and the Tennessee stud loves the Tennessee mare. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud.
Comrades. So tonight I'm going to be talking about perceived heathenism and Odinic prayer by Wyatt Kaldenberg. Now, this is about two trains of thought in Odinism. And when I say trains of thought, I'm really talking about procedures in Odinism rather than geopolitical ideas. The author talks about how there's the reconstructionist and there's the perceived. Now, in actuality, most Odinists and certainly most kindreds are going to be some of both. But to tease apart these two ideas, the Reconstructionist is an individual who really wants to rely on the study of the Eddas and the sagas and whatever other literature, for example, they might be able to find. So they really want to go into the books and any other perhaps medieval artifacts, that kind of thing. The perceived heathen is somebody who really wants to pray and meditate on the runes. Now, this author, really like so many other Odinists, really believes that study is a valuable background, but that only meditation, prayer, and offerings can really put us into direct contact. For practical purposes, the author tends to believe that the divine are like ancestors. Now, a gift is going to demand a gift, and so that prayer, obloat, and sacrifice will make the gods obliged to help us. And the author goes into daily and yearly schedules and highly suggests prayers at every 3, 6, 9, and 12 hour, and that this is more important than public worship. Now, the author does admit that it's hard to meet every prayer station all the time during the day and night, but says that this should be done whenever possible. The author goes into a story of a former Catholic priest, a man by the name of Mike Kinghorn, that used to write Gregorian chants for a kindred and even held Odinic masses. The author points out that it is incorrect to reject everything Christian because oftentimes Christians copied the Odinists. However, he does note that there are some Odinists. He particularly notes Elsa Christensen, who disliked this type of worship and banished it from the kindred when she took over. Now, this author really wants to discuss the practical aspects of Odinism and talks about finding rocks or even petrified wood when that's available and other materials to make altars for outdoor worship. This author has misgivings about the Wiccan movement and really fears that most Wiccans don't understand what they're doing. The author says that this can be dangerous because the spirit world contains all types of entities. Often, if you're praying a lot, the gods may be, frankly, too busy to answer you, but will likely send familiars, which are often animal spirits. But if you're unsuspecting, you may be tricked because really you don't know if there could be demons also. Now, the other thing about Odinism, even though it's very popular, specifically it is a Germanic religion, and as such, the various protective symbols that you'll find in Odinism tend to mostly help those of Germanic descent. Many people in contemporary Odinism, and particularly American Odinism, will often have Celtic or Slavic backgrounds. So these individuals will need to use extra protective symbols. Now, in the case of Celts, a wagon wheel should be used, whereas in the case of Slavics, an axe symbol should be used for additional protection. Then the author also goes into other more general protective symbols and says that they are very important. Also, a practitioner, if concerned, should publicly state what they're doing in front of other kindred members and, if necessary, should ask for help from their kindred. The author reminds us that contact can often happen when you least expect it. The author has learned to both fear and respect the runes because the author has realized over the years how very powerful they are. The author does admit that much of what we know about the runes, particularly in the case of the man in Futhorc, for example, is relatively new. And as far as perceived Odinism is concerned, this is absolutely fine because really you need to have a direct experience. Just relying on literature is never going to be enough, particularly when we've lost so much of the original meanings. Now, in the year 1902, von Liszt was temporarily blinded for 11 months after eye surgery. During this time, Odin appeared to him and explained the Armanen Futhor. Of course, for perceived heathenry, this is a wonderful thing and far better than any literature. The author, of course, goes on to say that there are a great many individuals in Odinism and in other religious beliefs that profoundly desire contact with the divine. To this end, individuals have employed various methods. Now, this author does not hesitate to give his opinion. This author really mistrusts the use of narcotics as a way of getting in contact with the divine. In fact, this author is very critical of the 1960s drug culture and also really believes that the CIA promoted the popularity of LSD back in the 60s as an attempt at mind control. This author, of course, does admit and does discuss at great length in this book the fact that there are cultures, such as American Indians, that will use hallucinogens to go on vision quests, for example. This author really believes that Europeans should stick to runes, mead, and shamanism. Now, if a person is very desperate for contact with the divine, the author also discusses sleep deprivation, says that this should only be done with supervision and is far more safe than ingesting any destructive substances. This author is also very fond of Jungian psychology and does believe in genetic, racial, and cultural memories. Now, as far as further reading on the subject, the author recommends for Odinists that they should read a book called Before Adam, which is by Jack London, and also the story Call of the Wild, which is also a Jack London story. And then a book by another author entitled The Drowned World by J.G. Ballard. The author also has macabre and, in that sense, perhaps they could be considered darkly humorous stories about various attempts to help convicts through prison ministry that often tended to go awry, and those should serve as warnings on issues of character. The author also discusses how prayer can help troubled individuals. This author is a critic of the movement to the point where he has written a pamphlet. Now, I have not read this particular pamphlet, and I'm not sure if discussing it on the show would be helpful or not. However, I did enjoy reading this particular book, and I plan on discussing other books by this author in the future. So, thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed my review. Hail victory, comrades.
And now it's time for another installment of that ever-popular series on Radio Free Northwest, Quis custodiat ipsos custodes? Who guards the guardians?
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Read every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number and taken away your name.
Apparently, the state of utter moral turpitude throughout federal law enforcement has now gotten so widespread and corrupt that even the Eric Holder Justice Department and now the Loretta Lynch Justice Department can no longer ignore it. Boy, if that ain't the pot calling the kettle black. Pun intended. An internal Justice Department report was leaked to the media several months ago, and I saw it at the time, but this is the first time I've been able to get around to it. Now, bear in mind that this is not me just saying these things. In this particular instance, I'm quoting and paraphrasing from an article from Business Insider dated March 26, 2015, but this has been all over the internet in a number of different websites and publications. A new Justice Department investigation revealed a series of shocking allegations of sexual misconduct by agency employees on Thursday. These allegations include sex parties funded by drug cartels, outlandish and fetishistic sex while on the job, extreme acts of sexual harassment against female subordinates, and much more. The accusations are the result of an Inspector General's investigation into the sexual harassment and misconduct policies of four Justice Department law enforcement agencies: the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Marshals Service, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. These incidents were cited in the report because they were not properly handled by the respective agencies, and many of the offenders were allowed to continue with their bizarre behavior even after it was reported. According to the report, a U.S. Marshal's supervisor learned that a deputy marshal had an inappropriate and romantic relationship with the spouse of a fugitive. Even after three supervisors instructed the deputy marshal to end the relationship, he nevertheless continued to pursue it for another year. Damn, this guy ignored three of his bosses telling him to break it off. That must have been one hot mama. The Office of Professional Responsibility apparently only found out about the relationship after it was terminated, because when the relationship ended, the fugitive's spouse lodged a complaint that her fed boyfriend had dumped her. In one particularly bizarre 2009 account, an ATF director apparently went through great lengths to facilitate sexual encounters while on assignment. According to the report, he, quote, solicited consensual sex with anonymous partners and modified a hotel room door to facilitate sexual play. Modified a door? Do I even want to know? Oh, wait, I'm looking down the article here. Apparently we're going to find out. In addition, the director, quote, removed smoke detectors from the hotel room and inadvertently caused damage to the hotel's centralized fire detection system. He's probably smoking marijuana during these sex sessions. Didn't want to trip a smoke alarm. After being confronted, he admitted it was not an isolated incident for him and had occurred in the past. It appears that the cited ATF director is likely Russell Vanderwerf, who held the same title and was reportedly involved in a similar incident at the time identified in the Inspector General's report. Here's how the New Orleans Times-Picayune described his hotel room modifications. Staffers and a deputy sheriff discovered that someone had removed the bedroom door from its hinges and replaced it with a 5x4 piece of plywood affixed to the frame and the drywall with hinges and screws. The door had two locks attached from the bedroom side and a circular hole padded with duct tape. The deputy noted in the arrest report that the hole appeared to be used in, quote, some sort of sexual act, unquote. The mind truly boggles. In one of the most headline-grabbing allegations in the report, drug enforcement agency employees admitted to attending sex parties with prostitutes paid by drug cartels. What's more, these allegedly loud parties happened on government property, creating security risks. Politico.com reported that these activities took place in Colombia. In particular, the inspector said that she explained to the Office of Professional Responsibility Management that the fact that most of the sex parties occurred in government-leased quarters, where agents' laptops, BlackBerry devices, and other government-issued equipment were present, created potential security risks for the DEA and for the agents who participated in the parties, potentially exposing them to extortion, blackmail, or coercion. A deputy U.S. Marshal who was conducting an extradition in Bangkok, Thailand, allegedly got involved with some local prostitutes. The situation got a little weird when they started talking to the federal government on his behalf. Each time the State Department called the marshal, and I'm quoting here, two women with heavy foreign accents answered the phone and stated that the marshal could not be disturbed. A local investigator for the State Department spoke to one of the women in Thai and confirmed that she was a prostitute. I can just imagine this somebody from the State Department calling this guy up in his hotel room in Bangkok and some 4'6" little Thai prostitute with black teeth, like I remember from over there, answers the phone saying, "Icky, icky, dicky, dicky, fucky, fucky, sucky, sucky." Oh, jeez. I'm sorry. Okay. Why not? All right.
America, America, may God thy refine.
An ATF supervisor failed to report his or her inappropriate relationship with an assistant. Apparently, they're not even given the gender of the people involved here. If they're hiding the gender, that probably means the supervisor might be female. And this involved, quote-unquote, an intentional misuse of government vehicles to facilitate that relationship, getting it on in the back of her undercover SUV, I guess. The supervisor was married, and his or her spouse, who was also an ATF employee, found out about the romantic entanglement and insisted that it be reported to management. A DEA assistant regional director allegedly made numerous inappropriate sexual comments to his assistant while stationed in another country, including a request to watch pornographic movies together. The person also routinely threw items, yelled at employees, and used other vulgarities in the office and at official functions, among other allegations. He was probably drunk or stoned. An FBI supervisor engaged in, quote-unquote, repeated instances of unprofessional behavior, including cornering his subordinates in their cubicles and displaying the size of his genitals by tightening his pants, making graphic and inappropriate sexual comments and gestures, and otherwise creating a hostile work environment, end quote. Now, instead of reporting his behavior, however, the supervisor was repeatedly told to cut it out. Accordingly, the subordinates experienced the supervisor's misconduct for approximately 3 years before it was reported to headquarters, said the report. Okay. I have visions of some rookie female FBI agent being assigned to monitor my emails and phone calls and also listen to these Radio Free Northwest podcasts and write up reports on all my horrible, treasonous, racist remarks. But even as she's listening to these very words, she's interrupted by her special agent supervisor who barges into her cubicle and wags his weenie, asking, "What you think of that there thing, honey?" Yeah, I know I shouldn't be laughing at this. These people are clowns, but they're killer clowns. And it is entirely possible that under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, one of these days, they're going to knock on my door, and when I ask them if they have a warrant, they're going to say, no, but I got a gun, and pump me full of bullets. And if they can get a so-called competent federal authority to sign off on it ahead of time, they'll just walk away and go to lunch, and nothing will ever be done about it. But, I'm sorry, just the very idea of these overgrown adolescents being entrusted with the security of this vile dictatorship just tickles the hell out of me. And in a weird kind of way, it gives me hope. Is this, honest to God, the best that America can come up with by way of muscle to keep that third world dictator in power? What do you think is going to happen if these turkeys ever come up against some really dangerous adult men who aren't in their 60s and 70s and who treat all this as a serious business and not a Porky's movie? God, I hope I'm around to see that day.
Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number, all they've taken away.
Okay, for a second music break, we'll have a little Prussian militarism here.
Greetings from Seattle. Andy Donner here. Some time ago, quite a few of the comrades in the homeland were gathered for a dinner party which ended up being very well attended. Consequently, I had the opportunity to catch up with quite a few people I hadn't seen in a couple years. One of them had cause to remind me that the Northwest Imperative and the Butler Plan are advanced material to most white nationalists. I didn't want to believe that then, and I still don't want to believe it now. But I'm forced to concede he was right and I was wrong. Just like Harold has repeated his concern that his own experiences cannot be taught, such as with the issues of costumes and streetwalking, I'm starting to fear that the basic realities of the need for the Northwest American Republic and how it must be brought into existence are essentially beyond the vast majority of white nationalists. And no, that's not intended as an insult. In fact, nothing I'm saying today should be construed to be insulting, since it is not. Everything the party presents on RFN is aimed at directly helping our listeners, especially the stuff we know they don't want to hear. Coming to the conclusion that the Butler Plan is the only appropriate course of action may, in fact, require exhausting all other possibilities in a series of attempts to resist coming to that exact conclusion. This is problematic because until someone gets to this point, they waste time, effort, and resources on doing everything but that which will actually help our race. A recent and memorable online interaction, which spanned several days, required me to answer most objections to the Northwest Imperative. Usually, this boils down to minor movement personalities moaning about how Harold Covington is the son of Satan, and that was certainly a factor this time around. But there were other proposals put forward which all insisted that it is wrong of the party to expect people to move their families away from locations already perceived to be their homelands, usually the Old South. But historically, that's how we've survived. All of our old homelands have browned out, and whites who didn't migrate away have mixed-race descendants today. The mere presence of non-whites is enough to guarantee a long-term problem which cannot be solved by political or electoral means. Those are the usual naysays, but there was one very special and new naysay which bears mention here. It's almost always the case that anti-Northwest naysays come from otherwise decent white nationalists. Most of the people I was talking to in this particular case strike me as just that, but they all latched on to a very bizarre theme. Apparently, the Pacific Northwest is simultaneously far too non-white for the Butler Plan to be effective, but at the same time, the population of the very same Pacific Northwest is totally unaware of the problems racial heterogeneity poses because there are so few non-whites here. If you need to, stop the program and listen to that again and again until it sinks in. There are, supposedly, simultaneously too many and too few non-whites in the Northwest for the Northwest Imperative to succeed. Yeah, I don't get it either. I was told this several times by different people and repeatedly by one person in particular. This is actually pretty typical of most refusal to migrate and/or to become involved in the Butler Plan. Otherwise intelligent and squared away white nationalists will say anything to avoid acknowledging the primacy of the Northwest Imperative as the only workable alternative to white racial destruction. Along the lines of refusing to learn, there's another issue which has come up and I'm almost afraid to address it. Let me emphasize right off the bat that I do not have personal issues with skinheads as such, but as with the Northwest Imperative in general, this subject specifically isn't going to be very popular, so my meaning will most likely be deliberately ignored in favor of all sorts of absurd accusations against the Northwest Front, because defaulting to bad behavior is easier than learning. Let me make it clear. This isn't about insulting skinheads, regardless of how I end up critiquing their particular subculture. In the recent past, I was contacted by some skins here in Washington State and asked to bring the local comrades to a counter-demonstration. This is, of course, immediately following a repetition of the party's stance on streetwalking and demonstrations. But hey, in the entire time the NF has produced Radio Free Northwest, it's not as if more than a relative handful of white nationalists have actually tried to put any of this into practice, so whatever. Anyway, I wasn't able to respond since I certainly wasn't going to agree to the request, and refusing, even with a perfectly reasonable explanation, would only have caused the exact situation I find myself in now. As it stands, we've got local skinheads frothing mad at us for not showing up to their little tete-a-tete with Antifa. Initially, I found out about this when someone got a hold of me and asked why we didn't show up. I shot back a reminder of exactly why we don't do these sorts of things. This devolved into an odd set of interactions in which I was told that the NF had asked for Skin's help in the past, and they gave it to us. I wasn't even going to talk about this at all until the possibility that the party asked for help demonstrating was put forth. That's the sort of thing I have to clear up immediately. The Northwest Front has always refused to participate in public activism, demonstrations, and marches because of the reasons Harold Covington and I have gone over and over several times on this program, so I'm not going to go there today. It follows that anyone claiming to have assisted the party in staging such activities has, in reality, not done so. If someone told you they were with the NF as pretext to putting on some sort of public shindig, they were lying. And even if they weren't lying, the best case scenario is that they're very, very wrong. I have no way of telling whether or not the skinhead in question was telling me the truth, which is why I need to clarify this. There have been times when the party has humored associates in the homeland who were going to put on various rallies and demonstrations such that we actually made it known to the public they were happening. This is, in light of the party's stated position on the matter, very, very confusing. For the record, these comrades are perfectly good people, even if they choose to deviate from policy on this matter. That said, I've been forced to have a talk with Harold about this, and in light of current events, we can no longer afford to humor our comrades in this way, since doing so probably contributed to the claim that the party asked for assistance with a demonstration of some sort. By the by, if this has ever happened, I would be very interested in knowing who claimed the NF wanted people to show up to something so out of step with party policy. Now, back to the actual dialogue with the Skins. The response I got from the first guy to ask me about it was something along the lines of, "But this is movement factionalism, and that's bad." Well, as it happens, this is not any sort of movement factionalism, because skinheads aren't a white nationalist movement faction. I know this is a bit of a shock to many people's systems, so allow me to explain. White nationalism, despite its sundry varieties and tendencies, leans towards National Socialism in its political desires. One of the most important aspects of National Socialism is its refusal to tolerate class warfare. I've spoken about this before, and Harold even did a shortcast on the subject, so I won't go into great detail about the theory behind all this. Even so, I should remind you all that class warfare is how communism and other Judaic philosophies get their foot in the door of white societies. Nothing good comes from class warfare, and exaggerating class-based differences is actually the worst thing to do. White nationalism cannot allow this sort of agitation for obvious reasons. But what does all this have to do with skinheads? Well, the skinhead subculture is actually the result of a tendency to celebrate an extreme low-class standing in Britain around 50 years ago. In the middle of the 1970s, racist elements were introduced into certain groups of skinheads. There have always been Antifa skinheads, though. Hell, there's even a contingent of gay skinheads. Yeah, really. The unifying element has always been the outward expression and flaunting of low-class status. Here's the rub. Just like it's rude, boorish, and offensive for the upper class to flaunt their status, it's rude, boorish, and offensive for their polar opposites to do the same, especially in antisocial ways. For these reasons, being a skinhead does not make you a white nationalist, even if there are some white nationalists who are skinheads. This is purely a matter of definition. It's not my intention to come down on anyone. Further, I'm not the only one who thinks this way. I've met an awful lot of people off of the old white nationalist email list the party used to operate. Prior to coming home, I was able to spend a decent amount of time with one of these comrades in the Kansas City area, and he was eventually forced to stop hanging out with the local skins because they would randomly hand out boot parties for no reason whatsoever. This is the low-class sort of behavior I'm talking about, and it's actually the stereotype of white nationalism in general. Further, while I was trying to figure out what originated this interaction with the skins, my logical and reasonable explanations of the party's position were actually met with an offering of physical violence as a solution to the disagreement. Why? Why do that? It should be understood that the party cannot afford to have anyone like this show up at anything we do, public or private. When introducing music breaks on RFN, Harold sometimes repeats requests that he stop playing egghead music. This mentality is exactly what I'm talking about today. There's nothing egghead about critical portions of Aryan history, and our music certainly constitutes such material. It's a very common attribute of the lower rungs of society to deliberately shun learning and remain as uninformed as possible. In presenting my material on the uselessness of the white nationalist streetwalk, all I've done is ask that our audience seriously consider the merits of this type of activism. That takes thinking, and thinking is bourgeoisie, so only the 1% can do it, right? Wrong. The reality is that, as individuals, any of us is perfectly capable of transcending class-based distinctions and engaging in serious political efforts to prevent the destruction of our race. But not while refusing to admit how this is best accomplished and act accordingly. I started this segment by acknowledging I have been wrong about something, and this admission is still entirely pertinent to what I'm saying now. As hard as I find it, I'm forced to admit the Northwest Imperative and what the party seeks to accomplish is still far beyond the reach of the vast majority of white nationalists, because the interactions I brought up today are entirely too representative of white nationalism's entire history, culture, and ongoing thought process. When Harold or I get on this sort of subject and stay there for a while, it's never for the purpose of deflating someone's ego. Quite the opposite. Races are made up of individuals. A strong race requires strong individuals. No amount of blustering is going to make up for the fact that, as a whole, white nationalism doesn't live up to its potential. The Northwest Front genuinely wants better than this for each and every one of you, skinhead or otherwise, and we do everything within our power to help you get there, but it does take some effort on your part. I've gone on a little longer than I would normally, so I'll cut it off here and wrap up these thoughts next time I'm on. Hail victory.
And here's some of that deep, profound egghead music that Andy was referring to.
Roland was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. The deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day, so he set out for Biafra to join the bloody fray. Through 66 and 7, they fought the Congo War with their fingers on their triggers, knee-deep in gore. Days and nights they battled the Bantu to their knees. They killed to earn their living and to help out the Congolese. Roland the Thompson Gunner, Roland the Thompson Gunner. His comrades fought beside him, Van Owen and the rest, but of all the Thompson Gunners, Roland was the best. So the CIA decided they wanted Roland dead. That son of a bitch Van Owen blew off Roland's head. Roland the headless Thompson Gunner, Norway's bravest sons of the score. Headless body stalking through the night in the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. In the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. Roland searched the continent for the man who'd done him in. He found him in Mombasa, in a ballroom drinking gin. Roland aimed his Thompson gun, he didn't say a word, but he blew Van Owen's body from there to Johannesburg. Roland the headless Thompson gunner,
Thompson Gunner.
The eternal Thompson Gunner, still wandering through the night. Now it's 10 years later, but it still keeps up the fight. In Ireland, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Berkeley, Paddy Hurst heard the burst of Roland's Thompson gun and body.
Okay, running way long here, so I just want to toss in a few final remarks vis-a-vis Andy's commentary on the subject of skinheads, so that there can be no misunderstanding, deliberate or otherwise, as to my attitude on the subject. Skinhead is an important part of our movement's history. I knew some of the original skins, both here and in Britain, back in the 1980s and the very early 1990s, when it was still a youth phenomenon like it was originally, and we're talking about young men of 18, 19, 20, or 21. They were, most of them, great guys, and I made some really good friendships in those days, some of which have endured to this day. Some of the very best people in white nationalism today are former skinheads, guys who survived that period of their lives, didn't end up dead or in jail, made good use of the lessons it taught, grew their hair, removed or hid most of their tattoos, and now they're raising families and holding down jobs and in some cases actually carrying the briefcases, as John Metzger predicted. Skinhead is not what it was. I won't get into what it has become because, frankly, I've lost track and I'm not really qualified to speak. It was always a youth phenomenon. I have to admit that I find the idea of a 45 or 50-year-old skinhead to be, well, pretty bizarre. More so than most white people, I think skinheads have a tendency to live in the past, especially that period from 1987 to 2002, which I call the Nutty 90s, kind of a 15-year decade from the year of Glenn Miller's freakout to the death of William Pierce. Now, one of these days, we in our wee little movement are going to have to sit down and have a conversation, as the lefty libs say, about the Nutty 90s. But that time is not now. I mention all this because immediately the goat dancers and loons are going to start screaming on the internet that Horrible Harold is quote-unquote attacking skinheads. No, I'm not. I try to remember the good and forget the bad. I listen to the music, and some of it I play on here every now and then, and I deeply mourn a lost potential and a lost opportunity. If you want to know what I really think about skinhead, I consider it to be one of the many tragically lost opportunities, possibly the last one we had, before the Butler Plan and the Northwest Republic became the only remaining way to go in order for us to implement the 14 words of David Lane. But now our time's up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, Uncle Bitter was their fate. Oh, what